My name is Don Rudrud, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota, where I'm a parish pastor at Our Savior's Lutheran Church. Several of you were here the first time, but I'm going to repeat some things today to help you catch up, because I'd like us to sort of start with a few basic ground rules about what we're talking about here in this group. Trying to talk about the challenge that the urban church faces. It's a challenge that is a bit different than every congregation, although some things I talk about you'll find very familiar no matter where you are. I would like to focus today on the subject of what it is that we do in ministry in an urban parish, and particularly what a pastor does in an inner city church. I'm not sure we all know that. At least I find in talking to people that there is some confusion and maybe some mystery. Some think that all we are is social workers. And I think by the time we're done today, I hope that you'll not only get an introduction to what a typical workload of a pastor in the inner city would be, but also maybe whet your appetite to some other sessions that will happen this particular week when we will look and focus on some particular aspects of ministry in the city. I start with an assumption that our call is to be in a parish. I call the parish the neighborhood around the church, the turf where the church has been placed. I believe firmly that we need to regain that sense of what the church's ministry is, no matter where it is. I'm afraid we have drifted too far into the direction to think that church work all has to do with the membership of a congregation, and that we call a pastor or a parish worker or a secretary or a custodian just to serve the congregation. But I think that although the congregation is vitally important and must be cared for, our call from the scriptures and from even the ordination vows that I take is to minister to people, whether they be in or outside of the church, to people in a community, to people in a neighborhood, to people who need the gospel. And the very reason for the existence of that worshiping community and that gathered community is in order that they might spread out with the love of Christ to all people, even if they be very different than us. We gather here today as basically very similar people, many of us Scandinavian. My name, Rudrud, is very clearly a Scandinavian name. Come out of the old evangelical Lutheran church tradition, and I go into a new church very soon, as many of you do, hoping that it will be more diverse, more pluralistic. What I'm going to push you on today and this week, if you're with me, is to think about how we can indeed enable the church to be more open, to be open to people that are different in culture and lifestyle and race and background. I put a chart on the board the other day, and I'd like to review it a little bit. It's a way that I sort of help deal with the dynamics that I see going on in my congregation, but it might be true in many places in the city. Many of our city churches, including possibly rural churches too, start with a rich tradition. The Word of God, the sacraments, their ethnic heritage. That tradition has built a good and strong church. And we still live with that even over a lot of years. My church is 117 years old. Any of you come from church older than that? Been in existence longer than 117 years? There are some. I've heard some up here talk about their churches being 140 years old. That strong tradition is a strength that we must understand and work from. We Lutherans have a rich tradition of our emphasis on the Word of God, the priesthood of all believers, the understanding of the rich worship life that we have, and we shouldn't deny that even in the city. So we start from this. There were a time when our city churches grew greatly because they had this to offer, but the immigration boat stopped coming from Norway, and the people did not continue to come into the city congregation. There was a time when you couldn't just put up a sign anymore and say, welcome, and everybody would come. So we experienced a time when these very independent, strong churches in the city experienced loss. Most all of them did. The only churches that I know of that have really maintained a large number and a viable strength in the city have been churches that have seen themselves as citywide churches. Sometimes the very downtown church will do that. Or churches that have a particular ethnic identity or a foreign language identity. Or churches that are very clear about their mission and attract people because of their clear statement of mission. Later in the week, I'll show you a book but I can tell you about it now, that has to do with the Church of Our Savior in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth O'Connor has written books about this church, called one of them called The Company of the Committed. That particular Church of Our Savior has, in the city, focused its mission so clearly and attracted people so strongly that it is now multiplied into many different congregations because of its clear sense of mission to the city and to the urban problems of the city. But most churches are like the one that I represent. Having been strong and independent, have experienced great loss in membership, Sunday school going from something like 400 students down to this year maybe 40, membership going from 2,300 down to 600. And in that time of experiencing great loss of membership, we go through the normal grief process. Most congregations go through grief processes all the time. But the grief process that I observe is people denying that things are not the way they used to be, wishing they were, bargaining, getting angry, hoping a new pastor would somehow bring them out of the doldrums and solve it all. And eventually having to work it through to the point where they accept the fact that there is death going on. There is death going on in congregations. As a matter of fact, every congregation, I suspect, is either at the point of losing members or gaining some, and congregations go through cycles. If this grief gets so intense and this change going on gets so intense that great conflict happens in the congregation, it can blow it apart. And we've seen that happen too. Some congregations die and should die, and maybe a new form can be emerging again. A difficult question we must always face as leaders in a congregation is our congregation dying, and should we let that happen? Or should we, in effect, have a funeral for the church? But there are congregations that work through this time of difficult change and conflict, even times when many members leave their congregation, to a new sense of mission, to a commitment of what they're meant to do. Basically, what this means, a commitment to stay in the city, not to move out, and to do what needs to be done for that community. I believe that what needs to be done is a pluralistic ministry. By that I mean a ministry that involves people that are very different, side by side, not asking them to melt together and be some kind of a melting pot of all kinds of different people, but rather affirming the fact that black people are different than white people, and Indian people do worship differently than Norwegians do, and that there may be people of different lifestyles. Let me give you an example. A woman called me on the phone a few years ago and said, she said, I've never come to your church, but I'm thinking about coming, but I'll tell you what, I've got a little baby here. I have no husband at home. I'm nursing the baby. If I come to your church, can I nurse the baby in church? I never thought of that question before. How do you answer that one? I mean, I got my own initial reactions, but I bit my tongue a little bit, and I said, wait a minute here. What I say to this woman over this phone will make a lot of difference on whether she comes to church or not. I won't answer what I said. I'd like you to think about what you would say. I know what people said in the 60s about the question, can you come barefoot to church? Or can you come with long hair to church? But we have different issues now. The issues that city churches have to face is, can you come into church if you have no money? Can you come into church if you've been drinking? Can you come into church if you speak Spanish and everybody else speaks English? Can you come into church if you're gay or lesbian? These are kind of different questions that are very much a part of what we have to face if we're going to be a pluralistic church, a church open to differences of people and allowing people to be different and not asking them to somehow melt together and all be the same. Our very worship service, especially in the Lutheran Book of Worship, is very heavily slanted towards Northern European understandings of life and culture. And so it itself is a bit of the problem. Ultimately, the goal, I believe, is that we develop an indigenous church in the parish, a church that represents the people who live around the church, that begin to take over the leadership and control. And for me, as a white Scandinavian pastor, graduate of St. Olaf College, that may well mean that I work myself out of a job. That ultimately, if my neighborhood is mostly Indian or black, I will celebrate the day when a black leader emerges, or an Indian spiritual leader can hold a Christian worship service affirming the scripture and the tradition that is part of our history, but also in their own cultural forms affirming the faith. And so in what I'm going to share with you a little bit, you'll see my bias towards trying to understand how the church can be indigenous. That's exactly what we're doing in foreign mission fields. The white missionary is clearly trying to work herself or himself out of a job to affirm the local indigenous people in leadership in the church. The sad fact about Lutheranism, as I've known it, is it's like a tribe. Lutherans are pretty interrelated. They're pretty tight-knit. Once a Baptist who studied Lutheran says, you know, I've come to know some of you Lutherans, and you're like a big net. He says, you're interrelated. You've gone to the same colleges. You know each other across the country. So I feel like I could pick up a kind of a net of Lutherans and dangle it like this, and you'd all be connected to each other. Now, at first, I wondered what he meant by that, but then when I went with my church council president, who didn't happen to be of Lutheran background, to a meeting of the district, and I noticed that I was out seeing all my friends and visiting over the coffee, and he was left all alone, he began to comment to me how much he felt not in the net. Lutherans are a little bit like a net, and this is a beautiful place called Holden Village, but it's something like that net, too. It's a kind of a Northern European net, where a lot of people of like mind and culture kind of gravitate together. What can we do to develop in our inner cities that may not be like this at all, an indigenous church affirming the church that is there for the people that are there? That's where I want to start, and I'm going to pause before I talk about the day in the life of a city pastor to just ask if you're with me so far, if you want to question me about any of this stuff. You sure can disagree with me, that's fine. Now, there's a little danger in what I'm going to do next. Pointed out to me by Barb Rossing the other day when she said when a pastor from Minneapolis wrote an article in the Lutheran Standard about the day in the life of his parish in suburban Minneapolis, he received a lot of criticism from other pastors because it said, what are you trying to do, brag about how busy you are? I don't want to brag about how busy I am. I don't think I'm any more busy than any other pastor. I think rural pastors have to work just as hard. I don't have any hero badge because I work in the inner city. It's not any more dangerous than anything else. All that stuff. I just want to share this with you because I think it's a kind of information that you may not know. In fact, I think it's the kind of information the whole church needs to know if we are going to truly be one body of Christ that really understands and cares for each other wherever we do work. But this, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, but it seems to me that the church now is a lot different than the church years ago. Yes. In their, they've changed their ideas about what they can do.
Yes.
And they're more, their freedom is greater now. They don't, when I grew up, it was a sin to play cards.
Yeah.
And now there's, they don't think that at all. Mm-hmm. All right, now who are they trying to please? Are they just trying to make it easier for the people, or were all the people a long time ago wrong in their thinking?
Well, now you're asking big questions that get us involved in a whole bunch of things, but I'd like to just focus on a little bit. The first part of your question I think I can deal with. You know, it's changed. Why isn't it the same? You know, why is it that it seemed like we sort of understood what was right and wrong then, and we don't now? I think it has to do with what I said about pluralism. I think we are now living in a world where we are learning many more different ways of living and many more people, including people naming the name of Christ, that live differently. When I was a child in Southern California, I wouldn't think of taking a drink of beer. I wouldn't think of going to a dance. That was just not part of my pietistic upraising. But I got away to college and even to seminary, I found that there were other Christians that had quite different points of view on that. I remember the story about the American women that went on a convention over to Denmark. And the women in Denmark from the church were very shocked at American women wearing lipstick. They were so shocked that the cigars fell out of their mouths. There are different ways of those kinds of personal ethic. And what one reason that it's in such turmoil now is that we are really starting to look at other people's lifestyle, even other people that are very different than us, and not immediately criticizing it or preaching against it. But we are beginning to try to say, let us really try to look and listen and see in what way Christ is incarnate in that. And let's also put our emphasis on what's the major thing and not the minor thing. I don't happen to believe that smoking or dancing or some of those things are the big issues. But the issue of racism, the issue of the exploitation of the poor, the issue of war, these things appear to us more and more to be the major moral issues of our time and have to have all of our attention. It's probably true that I've seen in my lifetime a movement away from the personal Christianity to a more sense of a Christianity that cares about the needs of society and a world that we live in. In fact, maybe that's the way all of us have to develop in our Christian life. We have sort of two conversions. We're converted to Jesus and what Jesus means for our own salvation. And then we're converted to the needs of the world around us. And maybe if you've seen it happen in your own life, that's good. You've seen some progression. But there's also a danger that we lose something that was good from the past. We lose some of this tradition. And that's why I'm convinced that the Lutheran Church that has a rich sense of that tradition should stay everywhere, including in the city, including in the foreign fields, and affirm that tradition of what we believe to be the heart of the faith, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the word and sacraments, law and gospel, and allow that tradition to, in a sense, inform this stuff, the new indigenous leaders, the new pluralistic understandings. Now, maybe that's too long an answer. But some of the rest of your thing, I think you better keep asking all week up here, because a lot of people are going to help you with that. Let me go into a little bit of this day in the life of a city pastor, and then I'll pause several times. I considered reading it. This little thing I wrote a year ago after an especially meaningful and busy day for me, and it was such a day that I thought, I better just sit down and write something down. So I wrote it down. But rather than read it to you, I'm just going to sort of speak it to you. And once in a while, I'll glance down here. It starts with a question that pastors all often get. I remember a confirmation student asked me this question. He happened to be black. And at the time he asked it, I didn't understand from what context he asked it. The question he asked was, Pastor, what do you do to earn a living? Another way the question is asked is, I know what you do on Sunday, but what do you do the rest of the days? Now, I didn't understand the context that young black boy was asking that question, but now I do. For I've now found that most black ministers in America work in secular jobs during the week and preach on Sunday. The reason they do that is because their congregations can't afford to pay them. And so they have to work in some way to earn their living, and then they preach on Sunday. And I didn't realize that at the time. I've been fortunate to be part of a congregation and a part of a church body that pays me even if the congregation is poor, because other help comes from denomination and other sources. Well, the questions, what do you do to earn a living, maybe brings me to write a few things about this day in July. The day starts at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'm at breakfast in a local hospital. We have a room given to us in the hospital, and it's in a monthly meeting we have of neighborhood religious workers. It's an ecumenical group. Now that is different than it was in the old days. In the old days, pastors probably would gather with Lutherans a lot. But this group, I'm gathering with the local Catholic priest, and here's the United Church of Christ pastor. But what's most significant about this breakfast meeting is that there are three Indian pastors there, American Indian pastors. We've asked them to come because we don't know enough about American Indian people, and our neighborhood has got 16,000 of these Indian people living in it. And so someone said, you know, there are a lot of Indian Christians here. Now, I don't see them on Sunday morning in my Lutheran church, so I'd like to know about them. So we asked the Catholic deacon, who's an Indian man. We asked the pastor from the Calvary Indian Church to come. We asked an Indian Lutheran who happens to be in our neighborhood and trained as a school teacher to come, and there was a woman there too, who is an Indian seminary student. We just listened to these people in that morning meeting, and as we listened, we found deep spirituality, a deep sense of God, very deep respect for religious tradition. We learned that in our neighborhood, that parish I drew on the board last week, roughly from 94 to 35W to Lake Street, that there are probably 8 or 9 different Christian Indian groups, all Indian groups meeting, and maybe as many as 250 to 300 Indian Christians gathering every Sunday morning. Well, that's some comfort. That's neat to know that that many Indian Christians are in my neighborhood, nearby. I didn't even know it. But more than that, we began to hear their frustrations. Frustrations at the white church, at white Christianity. They talked about the reservation. Little reservation in northern Minnesota, only 250 people, seven denominations up there trying to evangelize them. Christians fighting each other for the people. They learn something about Christianity they don't like. They want a religion that is open to all of the universe and all of nature and all people, and they find a Christianity that seems narrow. And so we talk about that. We talk about things that good Christian people have done to hurt them. And then towards the end of the hour, something happens that really humbles me. For in all our talk, we've never really paused to pray, or to read scripture, or to be traditional Christians. But the Indian man says, wait, before we go, can we pray? And he prays in a beautiful way. He prays both in the Indian language and in the English language. He prays the Lord's Prayer. And after that meeting, I became more and more aware not only of his depth, but more and more desirous to get to know him. After that meeting, I had the opportunity later to hear him play the Indian drum. I had an opportunity to worship with him with other Christians, and an opportunity to have him come to me and call me by my first name. It just began a growing relationship with that one Indian man, but an important part of my learning as a city pastor, to respect and cooperate with other Christians, especially Christian leaders that are of different culture than I. Well, that's breakfast. The meeting is over at about 9:30 or 10, and I'm back at the church office. And at the church office, I have an opportunity to meet with the other pastor and my staff. I'm blessed by always having at least one other pastor to work with. I think it's very important in the city. Too often we have set people out there to do ministry all alone, and they're dying on the vine. They're frustrated. They're having trouble with the immense problems and no one to talk to. Well, I can talk to my partner this morning, and we're talking about the question of budget cuts, because we've lost some budget money that we needed, and we've now lost the position of a visitation person for our elderly. In our congregation, we have at least 65 people on the shut-in list. They need to be visited with communion and regular home visits, and we wonder who's going to do it, because each of us have our own job descriptions, and now we've lost a staff member that was part-time doing that. And so we talk about it and strategize about how we're going to do it. We want to develop more lay people in doing it. And in the middle of our good conversation, we get interrupted. The church secretary is saying, there's a man out here that needs to see you right away, Pastor. And I recognize the man right away. He's Cambodian, from Cambodia. He's a member of our congregation. In fact, I baptized him. He came as a refugee a few years before. His English is very poor, but I realize that he is very upset and I must talk to him, so I excuse myself from the meeting with the other pastor and I sit with Pintan, the Cambodian. He says, my little girl, age 12, is in the hospital up the street, and they're talking about she goes to a mental hospital. Please come. Well, I don't know what this is all about. But I asked the secretary to change the rest of my appointments for the morning, and I drive the man up to the hospital. As I walk in the hospital room, I find 12 Cambodian people, none of them speaking English, really. Maybe one, a little bit. And the little girl is in the bed in convulsions. She's just shaking all over, moving like mad. I don't know what to do. The nurses don't know what to do. The doctors have taken some tests. And in fact, I can hear a little bit of the conversation among the Cambodian people, and they're talking about words like wrong medications and words like mental hospital. Well, what am I to do with people that do not speak my language, with people I don't even know that understand the same understanding of God that I understand? Do I pull out my little green book and read a devotion? What would you do? Anybody on a situation like that?
Let them know you're there.
Just be touch them.
Yeah.
Find out from the doctor what's going on.
Okay. I tried that, and the doctor was not there, but there was a nurse there, and a nurse was willing to talk to me privately. I talked to the nurse somewhat, and the nurse did in fact say that they were very mystified as to what was going on. It was very hard for them to understand. I did find that I could help the nurse by telling the nurse a little bit about the home situation where this little girl came from. A building that is filled with overcrowded conditions, where many people, many families sometimes live together in the same apartment. A building where her parents are often both gone working during the day, so she spends many hours there alone. It's possible that a traumatic event could have happened in that building. It's possible there could have been some violence to her that she was not able to tell them about. We did not know. I didn't get too much more information from the nurse, but I became an advocate, which is a common role of a city pastor. I said to the nurse, I think you need a bilingual translator here. Do you have one? Someone who can speak the language of these people. She said, no, we don't know of anyone right here, but I think we know where we can get one. I said, I'd suggest you get that one to help you to have the doctor talk to these people. They are very frightened of mental hospital, and they are somewhat concerned that this child has been given the wrong medication here in this hospital. They have even told me privately, which they did, that they were considering sneaking the girl out of the hospital. Well, the nurse listened to me. She was willing to do something about that. I went back into the room and I decided I would pray with the girl, even if everyone didn't understand. I did lay hands upon the girl. I did say a prayer. I think she heard me, but she was obviously terrified and still moving in great convulsions. And not knowing much more to do, the family seemed to be a little calmed down by this time I left, not knowing really what was going to happen. I had to leave, you see, because back at church, I was supposed to give devotions at Ladies' Aid. And they really do have in my church Ladies' Aid. It's not called ALCW. This is called Ladies' Aid. This goes back to the old, old days. These women are all in their 80s and 90s. They are very much the pillars of the church. They have been very friendly and supportive of me. But also, they are going through the experience of loss and grief. Every time they get together, somebody else has gotten sick or died in their group. And their group gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And they do remember the good old days when they actually, probably in the early 1900s, supported that church. They were the ones working there. They put on the Ludifus Suffers. They made that church go. And now things have changed so very much. They do need the pastor to be with them. They do need to pray with me and talk with me. And they asked me to lead devotions, and I did. And they were very helpful to me. It was a very traditional role that any pastor would do in any church. After leaving the meeting of those women, I went upstairs to get my phone messages. I called someone back to arrange a marriage appointment, which is, by the way, one thing that city pastors are asked to do often is conduct marriages, even of people they don't know, because people like the way the church looks or because people want to kind of anonymously get hitched in a way that isn't connected to their home congregation, and we have to really watch that one. After doing this and looking over a brochure that the secretary had prepared for neighborhood outreach, that we try to prepare every once in a while, something that tells the story of our mission, get it out, maybe the Boy Scouts take it out in the neighborhood just to get it out in people's doors so they know something about us. After looking that over, at 2:00 it's time for me to go and pick up Lucille. Lucille is in her 80s now, but she loves to visit with people, and I've determined that the way I can help Lucille, who's almost shedding herself because she's almost blind, is I take Lucille with me to go visit old-time members of the church, and Lucille does the visiting because she knows them so well, and they both have a great time together. So I took Lucille over to visit Hilda. Hilda lives on the Seven Corners area of Minneapolis, not too far from Augsburg College and St. Martin's Table. She overlooks massive new urban renewal and big hotels that have been built. Hilda's filled with stories about the tradition of the church and the choir that was made up of all women years ago that she sang in. And she loves to visit. And Lucille and I can't get out of there very quickly. It goes on and on and on. It's a hot day, and Hilda gives us a glass of 7-Up, even though it's very hard for Hilda to walk now because she must use a walker. She's had a nurse living with her, And at times I found that during this last year, I've had to be the one to sort of watch out for Hilda to make sure that she shouldn't be in a hospital or a nursing home. But she's intending to stay in that apartment until she dies, if she possibly can. Lucille does a great job. Lucille's father was a Preuss, and at one time was the pastor of the congregation. And she really knows the tradition. And here I, as sort of the younger newcomer, working together with Lucille, the tradition bearer, make quite a ministry team. We go on from there to visit Hazel, who's in the hospital. Hazel had a broken hip, also in her 80s. And it seems like every week there's one of these elders that goes into the hospital or needs nursing home care, and we have to be concerned about Hazel, especially getting her into a nursing home placement because she can't go back home to live again. It looks like she's going to move up to northern Minnesota now with a nursing home near her son, and so we're going to have to say goodbye to her. So we visit with her a while. I take Lucille home then, and it's about 4 o'clock. I decide I better get back to Children's Hospital and check on that Cambodian girl. So I breeze into the hospital and up to the room, and praise be to God, the little girl is quiet and laying there doing pretty well. The family is happier. They've had a chance now through a translator or someone to help them to talk to the doctor, and they feel a little bit better about the whole thing. They still don't quite know the diagnosis. She still may have to go to another hospital, but they're feeling better at this point. And they seem to be happy to see me, even though I'm still not sure they understood what I'm all about in that situation, other than just to be there and just to be a friend. And I'm still not sure I understand what I'm all about. Feel funny about leaving them again, but I better move on, so I leave them. And I go to visit another elderly shut-in. I have a special mission with this woman. I'm supposed to take her picture. Because what we try to do with these 65 people at our shut-ins is picture taken up on the walls over in the church so the people can see the elders that aren't there with us to worship. These are part of the congregation too. So I take her picture, and this woman loves to talk about angels. She'd be a delightful student in the class that's being held here with Ms. White about dreams and all of that stuff, you know, about the subconscious. For she experiences angels. She experiences strange presence in her room as she sits there by herself so many hours and days. She tells me about the time that she passed out and that she couldn't get to the telephone. She actually somehow knocked the telephone off the hook, but didn't get to the point where she could dial it. And she was there for hours and thought she would die, and then she prayed and prayed, and mysteriously some force comes into the room and moves the receiver and moves the phone so that she can get to it to dial 911. Well, what am I to do? My sophisticated theological education says that sounds like a bunch of baloney. But you know, I come to respect this woman and her spiritual depth so much that I just believe her. You know, I believe that she's got some contact with a sense of God that I need. And when I pray with this woman, I really feel blessed. While we're there having communion together, her daughter and son-in-law come into the room. They brought her supper because she really can't cook for herself very well anymore. And I found that visit was the last I ever had with her. For soon she was to die in a hospital very suddenly, and I had her funeral. And I was glad I had a chance to meet the daughter and son-in-law and get to know them just a little bit, even in that situation in the home. Well, that gets me to about 5 o'clock. Now you'd think if I was a sane person and not a workaholic, that's about time to go home. I had told my family, however, I wasn't going to be home for supper this night because I had some evening meetings. So I grabbed a hamburger on the way back to church, and kind of went back into the church. It was a hot afternoon. I went back into church and did something I do sometimes to unwind and kind of just relax. I turned on the air conditioner, which is kind of a luxury, and washed the communion glasses from my little communion set. That's something pastors have to do too. And after doing that, I looked at something that had been put on my desk, which was very interesting to me, which I want to tell you about. It was a list of the children that had been involved in the summer program for 7 weeks. We call it Kaleidoscope. It's a program that tries to make contact with the neighborhood children in the parish, around the church. We have all kinds of fun things. We go swimming, we make crafts, and we celebrate the cultures of the different children. So we have an Indian week and a Southeast Asian week and a Scandinavian week and a Black History week. And the children come of all those races. Well, I'd asked for the names and addresses of all these kids. And there were almost 100 names on the list. As I looked at the names, I only recognized 6 or 7 of them that came to our Sunday school. And so I became overwhelmed and depressed. All this work, who's going to contact all these people if we want them to be involved in our Sunday school? How do we get to these families? What are we going to do about this? And I just sort of stewed upon that a while. And by the way, I'd like you to think about that with me too, because we haven't found an easy answer to that one yet. We can attract the neighborhood kids to these kinds of programs, but to attract them to Sunday school on Sunday morning, especially if the parents have no interest in the church or at least don't get them up to come, is very difficult. And I'm not even sure children should come to Sunday school without their parents. I'm convinced that the great strength of the church's educational program is for the family to do that together, even if the family just be mother and children, or godmother and children, for that's another way we've got to look at how we do the work of the church, and that's really affirming the role of godparents. Well, what's going to happen the rest of the day? There's a little bit of time left, and at 6:30 I have a subcommittee meeting of the Adult Education Committee, and we brainstorm as what we should do in adult education. I'm convinced that one of the chief roles of a pastor is to be the director of adult education in a parish. Some say that the church should be a little seminary. It should be a little like what we do here at Holden Village in terms of the educational opportunities. I find a key role, an important role that I have, is to help guide the choice of the adult education program. We do search Bible study and feel that's very important. We do a Sunday morning forum, and we do women's Bible study groups in homes. But the forum especially brings us in dialogue with people of the community and of our parish. We often bring in people of color and people of secular leadership in the community in order to help us get informed and to learn how to deal with this changing time that we live in. Well, I came up with a crazy harebrained idea that time, but I'm glad I did because it worked. And then, as I said, let's start the year off good in the parish ed this year in adult education. Let's invite the mayor. Well, now, you know, for a congregation that's not too large and is sort of feeling a lot of loss and grief, that sounds like more than we dare ask, you know, to have Mayor Fraser come to this little church adult education committee. You know, would he ever even take a moment to even consider it? And I said, we need him here because we've got to talk about the issues of housing and employment. And I specifically reminded them that we have been operating in our church now for several years, a shelter for the homeless. And I'm really wondering how many years we can do that. Just keep opening up the church for people to sleep on the floor of the church every night, and then somehow say that we're doing what the Christian church needs to do. These people need more than that. What's the city going to do about permanent housing for these people? What about halfway houses? What about transitional housing? What's the mayor's plan? What's the federal dollar going to be in this program that needs to be developed? Well, the committee went along with me. Someone said she would invite the mayor, and sure enough, the mayor said yes. Not only did he say yes, but he was so gracious that one of our confirmation students asked if he could interview him privately for a school project, and I walked into my office, and there they were talking away, interviewing him for a school project. So that was great. Well, we planned then several events that we were going to do in adult education, and then after that meeting, the full committee met of parish education, and we struggled with probably the hardest issue of all, and that's how to do a Sunday school in the inner city. I've known many churches in the city that have closed their Sunday school down. I've known some that have tried vastly different programs than anything you would ever recognize as Sunday school, and I still feel there's a need for Sunday school. There's a need for that basic Christian education. But how to do it, how to get committed teachers. We attract several young adults into our congregation, but many of them tend to be the kind of people that are very super involved and active, and especially active on weekend events. It's very hard to get the committed, Christian, gifted young adult to commit themselves to teaching every Sunday class in Sunday school. So we wrestled with that for a couple hours, didn't resolve at all. and went home, and I went home to a family that somehow understood and accepted the fact that I was gone too long. And I'm not gone that long every day, but that's sort of one day. This day I've outlined is not to highlight its busyness or to claim that it's a daily occurrence. I share this day because it is a unique way. In a unique way, this day represents the variety of events and opportunities for ministry that are part of my life. Insofar as this day helps us to understand the life of an urban pastor, I hope it can help us realize in the midst of the people of God in the city a part of our total life of the Christian church. I want to pause now and give you a chance to get involved in this. In fact, we've got a lot of time for you to get involved. What do you think about what you heard? Do you think I should have spent my time a little differently? And I'm not thin-skinned about this. I'd like to hear from you. Anything surprise you or start you thinking about something? Yes.
I'd like to go back to the woman that called you that wanted to come to church with her baby and nurse.
Yeah.
You don't want to say what you're thinking now, but we have had a little problem this summer. A fellow was, I don't know, what would you say, pickles, sent to get Ashland for, we heard that they wanted to get rid of him someplace. Some city, and they sent him to our county, and the county, he went to the county, okay, he came to our church. He dresses like a woman. He's different.
Yeah.
Okay, he disturbed our congregation, really, when he came to the services. Mm-hmm. You know, he walked us so, and with the get up and so forth. How do you accept someone like that? Now, the last time I heard that, I think the pastor told me ushers to, of course, watch or tell him that he should come in and sit. He'd sit down and then he'd get up and then go another place. And it distracted us from everything that we were doing in church.
Yeah.
It distracted the minister, too.
Sure.
Right.
There's a little bit more to that.
Yes, I know. He'd gone to another church.
Where the problem came in, he went into the local Baptist church one Sunday, and he picked up a child out of the nursery and was going to walk out with
him. Sure. Well, that's bad stuff.
This was very frightening. They have a list on them at the police station and the sheriff's office, at least that long. Mm-hmm. He has done several very funny things.
Oh, it sounds like the man is very ill and needs help.
They did stop him the last time he came to church.
Yeah. I've got two or three responses. One is that I think we need to do more than just kick him out.
He wasn't kicked out.
A couple of things like that have happened in my experience, and I've always been pleased to have someone in the congregation, and it tends to usually be someone who's had a little experience with social work or has experience with these kind of people, go over and sit next to them, the first thing. And then if the behavior becomes so inappropriate that it is disturbing people, that person can help get them out into a private place and talk to them privately. I think that's important. I was at the Glide Memorial Church in San Francisco to visit a few years ago. Actually, it was after I'd been here to Holden. And right before the service, they were singing some rather lively music, and some people got up and started clapping and hallelujah. And then this one woman got up, and she went right up in the window well. And, you know, she was dancing around there up in the window. Pastor came out at the beginning of that, and he immediately just saw that happening. He walked right over to her, took her by the arm, and walked her right out of the church. I mean, that was... a way to tell everybody, we can really have a good time here and we can really do all kinds of things, but there's certain stuff that doesn't go. It's not unlike when you have a little child screaming and yelling and the pastor says, I think the mother should take that child out. But the church does have to learn how to deal with the mentally ill. I think in my neighborhood now, we have halfway houses and group homes. We have mentally ill all around us, and they walk into our churches and they need us. You know, and we are important to them, especially, as we'll talk more later this week, there's new policy in most of our states, I think it's federal policy, to try to open up, close down at least, some of these mental hospitals. They're releasing more and more of these people into the community. The theory is that the community has to be a way to give them care closer to where they live. And that's a beautiful theory, but we haven't figured out all the ways to do it. And maybe the churches are going to have to take some of the lead on that. The churches are going to have to understand. If we are pluralistic, it may mean that we have certain gatherings just for the mentally ill and allow them some rather unusual behavior. I don't know. You raise a real difficult question, but let's keep coming with those. That's fine, yeah.
My question is clear on the other side of the sphere there. Is there a danger that tradition can make our worship become too mechanical?
Oh, of course. And, you know, I love the Lutheran Book of Worship, but we've had that long enough now that I'm getting the same kind of feelings, not only I am, but others are telling me that we had with the old Red Book. You know, you're saying it from rote, you know, it's not only that tradition, saying the Lord's Prayer, it's doing devotions at meetings. Even the question of passing a little offering plate at every meeting of the church, what a strange tradition. Where did that come from? It seems to keep going. I can't stop it someplace. I mean, it just keeps going around this offering plate. Some of those traditions. Some of us have need to ask questions. Why? You know, or ask questions, how can we do it a different way? The other night, Elmer Witt did the evening vespers backwards. Delightful. I mean, we did the whole thing. We did the benediction first, you know. I think some of us need that. Worship especially, if we're going to be pluralistic, I think has to be in many different forms. What we're doing in our particular parish now is every Sunday we offer two different forms of worship. One very informal, free prayer, guitar, communion with a loaf of bread, sitting in a circle. We do a traditional service with LBW. One Sunday a month we switch the hours around so people kind of get mixed around in terms of hours. And we are moving, I hope, within the next year or two to having another service that will be out in the community, completely away from the church, for people that are church shy about that tradition of even going into a church. An even greater dream I have is when we'll have a service in the Hmong language for the Southeast Asians, or maybe an all-Indian service. I think that's that pluralistic way of doing worship and allowing, let's say, a traditional white person like me to go in any one of those. That is what the church of the future is, I hope. That we don't get so bound in that tradition. Now, it's harder for some of you who live in a town where everybody is pretty much the same to do this. I admit it. I mean, it's much easier for me to experiment with all this kind of diversity in the church I'm in. I know that. Other comments and questions?
And how is it going to be now then with a new church?
It's going to be still up to your local congregation to decide how you want to do things. No national group is going to come and kind of control your local congregation, but I know this, that the new church is going to be more national, more diverse than any Lutheran church I've ever been a part of. It's going to have a lot more urban people. It's going to have a lot more black people. It's going to have people from the East Coast that I haven't been used to in Minnesota, and that's good. I will really feel like finally I'm part of a national denomination, because up to this point I felt pretty much part of an upper Midwest organization.
I have a question about accountability. I happen to be a member of the council. I'm in a church, it's a Two Point Parish, and I am an organist in the other parish. Yeah. And project yourself into this little community doing all these things, which our pastor also has a wide variety. Yeah. The church for I'm an organist is very critical. You know, he wasn't in the office at the time that he was supposed to be. And I get frustrated trying to defend him because I see some of these things, but, you know, whatever I say falls on deaf ears. Yeah. The congregation that I am a member of are very supportive of him, but this other congregation, you know, he was not in his office at 9:30 like he was supposed to be.
Sounds like, and both churches are paying his salary?
No, it's in the church where I'm the organist, but not my work.
Oh, I see.
Salary is paid by
Yeah, right.
They're contributing.
Yeah, they are contributing.
So part of the problem sounds like they're jealous of getting enough of his time.
Very definitely. That's right on the nose.
Well, boy, I don't have any. I only feel pain.
That was on there for a week.
Yeah,
you would enjoy it. Take
more than a week to get there. The pain that brings up is my own father-in-law. I was a pastor in southern Wisconsin on the same kind of a situation. And he was within 2 years of retirement, serving both churches, a beloved, great pastor, great man. And he was fired from the smaller one of the two. 2 years before retirement, they said, you just go serve the other one because we don't think we're getting what we want from you out here in the small one. Sad thing. That's so different from my experience, I can't help you. There's a couple things I would say to those who say to me, what are you doing, and we're not sure you're in the office when you're supposed to be and everything. If in my parish, I would say, first of all, if I advertise office hours, I should be there, or I should clearly have a secretary know where I am. And secondly, I give my church council sometimes a report of what I've been doing. You know, so the council sees it right out there. This is what I did during this month. You know, these are the meetings I went to and so on. I don't think we should be afraid to say that. Because a lot of people don't honestly know. You know, they really don't know what pastors do.
Well, he spends a day there, and he'll have, they've always had office hours down there.
Yeah.
Nobody comes
to the office.
I have offered to write a job description based on what, I mean, this is facetiously, of course, based on what their expectations of a minister are. And it's more than a 24-hour job.
Yeah.
But I'm just speaking out of my own frustration at not being able to defend them, because I don't know what to say except I explain it like that he's busy doing other things.
Yes, the back row. Excuse me.
Does more burden for ministry fall on your shoulders than ought to? Or are you doing things that the parishioners or people in the congregation couldn't do it? It just takes a pastor to do this.
Yeah.
And are you busier than you ought?
Yeah. Well, those are all very important questions, and maybe you should answer your own questions by what I shared with you. You know, I'd be willing to listen.
I'm just interested in what you say.
I think generally pastors are forced into and do take, because of their own ego needs, much more responsibility on their own shoulders than they should. The most effective and gifted pastors are the ones who can enable others to do the ministry, who can get out of the way. I think I should be doing more of that. I don't think I should be working that long a day. That's when I work that long a day, that kind of tells the congregation, well, he'll do it all for us, you know. You know, if I could, and I'm partly on this sabbatical here for 3 months to kind of step back from that and get some new perspective on what I'm doing. But if I could plunge back into what I'm doing, I think I'll see myself more and more working with small groups to help train them. I'd like to form a little seminary in my community that helps to work with Southeast Asian and Indian people to enable them to become the leaders, you know, to do the work. I just don't think that I have the equipment or experience to be the evangelist, to be the teacher for many of their people. But I do have the training and ability to help encourage them and to work with them. So that's part of it. I try to do some of this when I brought the elderly woman with me in the visitation, you know, to affirm her leadership. You raise the real important questions. And if you look at the churches that are growing in the world, and not just in this country, but that are growing, it's those churches who effectively mobilize their laity. It's an old concept that Martin Luther had, the priesthood of all believers. We're all priests, we're all in the ministry. But somehow we've got sucked into this business that the pastor does it all. And what my father-in-law faced in that small Wisconsin idea was that the ministry was done by the pastor. The ministry wasn't done by the people, it was done by the pastor. That was the way they understood ministry. Anybody was sick, the pastor had to be there at the hospital right away. Anybody needed counseling, the pastor did the counseling. Anybody needed preaching, the pastor. You go to every meeting in his parish and the pastor gives devotions every meeting. And that kind of style of ministry is death for the church. I think it's going to make us an ineffective small group in the future. And so we need to change a lot of things. One of the good signs of hope in our seminaries is no longer are we training people mainly with the lecture method, but we're more and more working in groups and teams in our teaching, and that's important. More dialogue like we're trying a little bit of here, too.
I am fortunate. I happen to belong to a church that has that uses their lay people in committees, and there's the one committee, or whatever you call it, is called Reaching Out in Love, and once a week these people go out in teams and call on prospective members, they call on shut-ins, and it's a regular thing.
The Stevens Series is another excellent program of training lay people. One other thing I thought about, to help what you're talking about, to keep pastors honest and limit them, is something called a pastoral support group, or a pastoral, we used to call it pastoral affairs group, but that sounds kind of strange. But that group of lay people meeting with the pastor every month can really talk about some things. Talk about when the pastor should hold back. Talk about some these rumors out in the parish, you know. Maybe help the pastor get some perspective, because one of the sad things that those of us in our profession face is that there's very few people to talk to. If we're married and we got somebody that likes to talk church, that's fine. My own wife gets sick of talking about it at times, but we need somebody to share with and to kind of get perspective. One of the great gifts of team ministry, working with more than one pastor, is that you can continue to have staff meetings and talk about some things and kind of help each other. I work with pastors that tell me to hold back and to not try to do so much. And that's good for me. I need to hear that from somebody. It's kind of good for me even to leave the parish for 3 months and believe it's really going on back there. You know? It's probably going to be more vital than when I left. We got about 4 minutes left.
You didn't say anything about sermon preparation.
That's right.
Just sort of mulling this over in between times as you drove from one to the other.
I'm glad you raised that, because I thought of that when I was going to read this. No, I mulled nothing over that day. As a matter of fact, as I remember, that day was Thursday, and so I had to deal with the fact of Friday and Saturday to get that sermon finished. Now, I do personally go to a text study, and I was privileged this year, by the way, to have Barbara Rossing in my text study, which was a real gift, and a pastor that she worked with, Jonathan Preuss, and Charlie Mays, who's had a lot to do with this place up here, some excellent Bible students. And every Wednesday morning, we go together and study the scriptures, so that helped me get started on the text. But I didn't have it written on Wednesday like they told me in seminary I should. I probably didn't get it written until finally Saturday night. There's another thing about my style of ministry, however. I don't believe that I have to be in the pulpit every Sunday.
No.
So I maybe wasn't preaching that Sunday. As a matter of fact, I have now always, I've had one other pastor and an intern pastor, and as of now we have husband and wife team each half and half, so we'll have three preachers that are rotating. I still see my role as a pastor is primarily adult education, teaching, and having something to do with community organization. That group that I talked about at the beginning that met in the morning, an ecumenical group of Catholic and United Church of Christ and Methodist, I had a little bit to do with getting that going, and it took us 7 years to get it going. I mean, you just don't send out an invitation and everybody shows up to those kind of meetings. You gotta work at it slowly, especially in a city like Minneapolis where Lutherans are so strong that they're just used to kind of getting together as Lutherans. They don't need anybody else at times. I was in Madison, Wisconsin, where it was very ecumenical. In fact, we had a Jewish rabbi in our neighborhood who came to our meetings and studied scripture with us. What a delight to have a Jewish rabbi look at the New Testament text with you. You know, I mean, I just long for places like Madison, Wisconsin, where you could do something like that. Well, I want to say before we end a little bit of where we're going, if you still want to be with us for some of the other sessions, and I know some of you like to hike and do other things, but I won't. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to talk about the question at 10:45 of urban evangelism, or how to reroot the congregation in the neighborhood, this whole question of indigenous. And I don't have a lot of answers on this, but I sure got a lot of questions. And I know some people that are doing some good work. We'll talk a little bit about the church growth movement, the question of homogeneous church, question about how we can make the church come alive again in the city. On Thursday, we'll talk about the church and the homeless, and especially what we do about the many people on our city streets. In the city of Chicago, right this year, there are 99 different shelters and churches that are sheltering homeless people. Thousands of people on the city streets of Chicago with no home to live in. We'll talk a little bit about that and what our particular church has done, but also what we think has to be done for the homeless in the future. On Friday at 6:30, the question about gentle justice for refugees, especially Southeast Asian refugees. I want to talk about something other than sponsorship. You've probably heard a lot about sponsoring refugees. And you've heard something about the Salvadorian refugees maybe, but I want to talk about those people who've been in this country for 1, 2, 3 years that sometimes we kind of forget about, and what's happening to them in cities like mine. And then finally, probably the most exciting topic, I don't know if we'll even do this one because it's prime time, 8:30 Saturday night. You may be rather be at a party then, but if there is no party and if they still keep this on the schedule on 8:30 Saturday night, we're going to talk about rebuilding the city from Nehemiah's day unto the Habitat for Humanity. Talk about different programs all over the country where people are involved as Christian church people to get their hands dirty and actually rehabilitating the city and not just leaving it up to the urban renewal people or to the public housing authority. And there's some really exciting things. Even a guy like Jimmy Carter has had his sleeves rolled up and has been out working on the streets. And so we can talk about that a little bit. That's on Saturday. If you would like us to talk about something a little differently, please raise that question with me privately or anytime, because I can be very flexible on this. But thank you for your participation this day. Enjoy the rest of the day.